Thank you. Yeah, so today I'm going to talk about some results from simulations of what happens when you have spinning neutron stars merging with black holes or other neutron stars. So I should say this is work done in collaboration with a couple of people, Vasilis Paskatilis and Franz Pretorius at Princeton and Stu Shapiro at Illinois. And if you're interested in more details, you can check out these references on the archive. So here's a brief outline of what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to begin by motivating why we're interested in studying compact object mergers, so probably don't need to dwell on that much for this group. In this talk, I'm going to focus mainly on a particular subclass of binaries that are dynamically assembled. So I'll talk some about that subclass of binaries and how they compare to the more traditionally studied primordial binaries. I'll sort of motivate why it'd be interesting to consider the effects of neutron star spin on the dynamics and outcomes of these mergers. And then I'll present some results from simulations. I'll tell you about a couple results from simulations of black hole neutron star mergers, and then switch to talking about binary neutron star mergers involving spinning neutron stars. And I want to spend a good chunk of the latter part of this talk focusing on this one-arm instability, which is this particularly interesting instability that we found to occur in the hypermassive neutron star that you can form from the mergers of two neutron stars in the cases that the two stars don't immediately form a black hole. And then I'll conclude and talk about future work. So first of all, why are we interested in studying compact object mergers? First of all, these are one of the few systems that allow us to probe strong field gravity. That is the regime where space-time is not only highly curved, but it's very dynamic. This is a regime where we haven't really been able to test our ideas about gravity thoroughly. And related to this, these systems are really the primary sources that the gravitational wave detectors like Advanced LIGO that we're all very excited about now are targeting. For mergers involving neutron stars, these are particularly interesting. First of all, we hope to use observing these mergers to find out something about the supernuclear density equation of state that sort of sets the size of the neutron star and its properties. And also, when you have matter, there's a lot of excitement about doing multi-messenger astronomy, where from these mergers involving neutron stars, they're thought to be progenitors of short gamma-ray bursts to potentially eject material from the merger event that could undergo radioactive decay and through the R process power transients. And there's other mechanisms like this. So with all these electromagnetic transient surveys coming online, there's a lot of excitement about trying to do multi-messenger astronomy. And by observing these systems with both gravitational waves and electromagnetic signal, find out the sort of most we can about these things. Perhaps the more traditionally studied type of compact object mergers are those occurring in primordial binaries. These are systems where you have stars that are already in bound systems that collapse to form black holes or neutron stars. And these are basically expected to merge with essentially no orbital eccentricity by the time they get to separations where you can measure them with advanced LIGO. Or other instruments. And that's just because gravitational waves are so efficient at radiating away orbital eccentricity. And these are really the main events that Advanced LIGO is proposing to go after. There's some estimates about what these event rates are. There's considerable uncertainty, several orders of magnitude, but we're all very excited that any day now we'll start seeing lots and lots of these events. But in addition to these primordial binaries, there's another class of binaries that can be dynamically assembled in dense stellar regions, such as the cusps of galactic nuclei or the cores of globular clusters. And this can happen through dynamical capture, where the two bodies pass by each other, lose energy to gravitational waves, secondarily to tidal effects, and then form a bound system. There's also been a lot of interest recently about exchange interactions, three-body effects that can also drive these systems towards merger. So a subset of these will merge with large eccentricities. And the event rates for these are sort of even less well understood than for the primordial binaries. Talk about a little more about some work that people have done in that regard in the next slide. Even if these are sort of more rare, they're particularly interesting. Some work that I and other people have done has sort of shown that once you add eccentricity into the mix, you get sort of large variability in the outcomes of the merger with this extra orbital parameter. And you can see sort of a large variability in both the outcome and the gravitational wave and potential electromagnetic signal.
So the number that Lyon calls assumes primordial binaries?
Yeah.
Always.
These come from population synthesis models of these.
Population synthesis.
Yeah.
So meaning that they take into account that if you have a binary star and one of them explodes, they take into account the probability that the other star may go away too?
Yeah. Yeah, so there's a lot of messy assumptions that go into that, which is why there's this uncertainty, but yeah. Yeah, so there has been some work to try to understand the event rates for these dynamically assembled binaries. Recently, there's this work by Antoni et al. This year, and they looked at forming binary black hole systems in globular clusters through these hierarchical triples, this so-called Kozai mechanism. And they found that they came up with numbers of something like event rates for advanced LIGO of a couple per year. And they estimated about 20% of those would enter the LIGO band with non-negligible eccentricity. Looking at black hole neutron star and binary neutron star systems. There were some estimates by Lee et al. That came out with numbers something like 10 to 100 per year per cubic gigaparsec. Some more recent work by Samsung et al. Indicated that these should actually be dominated by single binary encounters that will give you rates of something like 1 per year per gigaparsec cubed. And then there's also been some work to try to understand how observable these gravitational wave signals from these events might be. And so if you sort of combine those with those event rates, you get, again, something that could potentially be on order of one event per year for advanced LIGO. And sort of the majority of these dynamically assembled systems will still merge with low eccentricity, but a fraction of them will merge with larger eccentricities. And of course, here there's a lot of assumptions that go into making these event rates. So if you make different assumptions about things like the retention rate of neutron stars in globular clusters or things like that, then these numbers could change. But we're also just sort of beginning to understand the effects of things like three-body interactions and how these contribute to the event rates. So. I think it's sort of still an open question what exactly these event rates are, or we should expect them to be. So from the point of view of considering dynamically assembled binaries, spinning neutron stars are especially interesting. And that's just because if you look at the distribution of binaries in globular clusters, just the distribution of neutron stars and globular clusters, they tend to be spinning pretty rapidly. Actually, the periods peak in the milliseconds. So if you look at this sort of survey of like 144 currently known pulsars in galactic globular clusters, more than 83% of them have periods less than 10 milliseconds. More than half of them have periods that are less than 5 milliseconds. And about 12% of map periods, they're less than 2.5 milliseconds. And you know, the reason for all these rapidly spinning neutron stars is that globular clusters are good places to form these low mass X-ray binaries, where you can form these recycled pulsars, where through accretion the neutron star gets rotated up to pretty rapid spins. And also, if you sort of look at the magnetic field strengths that you could infer from their spin down rates, they're low enough that the time you expect to take for these pulsars to spin down is sort of or the characteristic time scale is sort of on the order of 4 giga years. And so that gives these pulsars plenty of time to potentially form binaries and emerge before they completely spin down. Given that we expect to see these rapidly rotating neutron stars in binaries formed in globular clusters and so on, why might it be interesting to include the effects of spin in these simulations, and what kind of effects might we expect to see? There's been a number of works recently looking at the effects of spin in binary neutron star mergers, Nielsen et al., Bernoulli et al., and so on. And basically, these simulations have shown that even moderate spins can have effects on the dynamics and outcomes of the merger. So there are a number of things you might expect. First of all, if you just look at an isolated star, as you increase the spin, it's no longer going to be spherical. It's going to get squished down. And also the compaction is going to increase due to this extra centrifugal support. And so, that you might expect that to have sort of similar effects to having a stiffer equation of state. You have less compact neutron stars, they're more easily tidally disrupted. Second, if the period of the pulsar is sort of order milliseconds, that's also the same time scale as the sort of orbital time scale. And so then you can also expect it to start having effects on the orbits. Once these things start to get tidally disrupted or merge, this extra velocity from the rotation can affect the size of the accretion disk and potentially the amount of unbound matter. And finally, for the binary neutron star case, when these two neutron stars merge, they won't in all cases immediately collapse to a black hole. A lot of times they're supported by both thermal energy and rotation. And so you can definitely expect that this extra angular momentum from spin can either add to or subtract from the orbital angular momentum and then affect whether or not you get a hypermassive neutron star and how long it will live. And finally, as I mentioned, for some of these dynamic, or for the majority of these dynamical capture binaries, you might still expect them to see them merge with low eccentricities. So in order to start to disentangle these two populations of primordial and dynamically assembled, one way might be to look for the effects of spin. And so if you can sort of see characteristics of a large spin in the outcome of the merger, that might be pointing towards one of these types of binaries. So the main tool I'm going to use to begin to investigate these questions is just numerical simulations of Einstein's equations coupled to hydrodynamics. The dynamically assembled ones that occur in like globular clusters and so on. So these are pretty standard methods these days, solving the Einstein equations coupled to the model for the stars, just the perfect fluid, and evolve the relativistic Euler equations. Here we're using the generalized harmonic formulation and these usual conservative high resolution shot capturing techniques. And for the initial data, I can just take, what we do is take one of these isolated rotating neutron star solutions, and then you can superpose them and then resolve the sort of for a conformal correction to the metric and so on to get a consistent solution to the Einstein equations. And this allows you to you know, consider high spins like all the way up to breakup. So I just wanted to present a couple of results from some simulations of black hole neutron star mergers where the neutron star is spinning. And just wanted to illustrate two points, both that spin can have a significant effect on the amount of matter that's unbound from the system, and correspondingly on the amount that remains in accretion disk after you have the final black hole. And it also can affect the threshold for merger on these given close encounters, which will also be reflected in the gravitational wave signal. So just to show you an extreme case for illustration, this is a simulation of the 4-to-1 mass ratio black hole neutron star system, where the neutron star is basically a millisecond pulsar. And so it's a little below its breakup spin. So here I'm showing you a little animation of the density. And in this case, the star gets pretty strongly, tidally disrupted. And you get this very long tidal tail and lots of ejected matter.
So
if you look at this plot here, this shows you the amount of unbound rest mass put into velocity bins. The case we just looked at is this yellow curve with a very high spin. But then if you look at even lower spins, you can see that you still get a sort of significant effect. So you can see that the sort of characteristic velocity here is on the order of 0.3 times the speed of light, or 0.3 times the speed of light. It's in the opposite direction of the orbital angular momentum. Yeah.
So much of this is above a fine production threshold. So there is some material that can impact on the signature in the gamma.
You're asking about in the unbound material or in like
the unbound material, if it's sort of properly exploded, right? Mm-hmm. If it's 0.3 from the speed of light, that's above the prime production threshold, so you can get pi zero and gamma.
Yeah, normally people talk about having these R process transients from this, which will be in the
infrared.
Yeah. So the usual picture is that as this ejected material goes out, it'll undergo the R process, and you'll build up these heavy elements that are undergo radioactive decay, and that'll give you.
I'm just saying that if 0.4 V equals 0.4 C neutron or proton encounters another that is at rest, that pi zero or something like that is created with hyperbolic, so you can get 15 million gamma.
That I haven't heard discussed. What he's saying is that
in this kind of will be a synthetic
neutron capture signal would just take you heavier and heavier elements, and then they would decay in this process.
The very sharp cutoff that you see there, is that an artifact of the plotting, or is that the real thing?
So definitely true. You're not getting much material. Basically not anything that
but
I trust.
But why cut off so abruptly?
I don't know if there's a I mean, I think that's just sort of the maximum velocity that you have for, you know, the collision and considering the spin velocity on top of that.
I was going to ask, so in the simulation, you have 6 orders of magnitude between lower atmosphere and central density. So this is a collision that happens in fictitious media.
Yeah, I mean that lower scale wasn't actually the atmosphere.
Oh,
yeah. I mean it's more orders of magnitude lower, but yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so you can see that just even in this extreme case, you're getting sort of almost tens of a percent of a solar mass, but even with smaller spins corresponding to periods of a few milliseconds, you still get, you know, enhancement of a few, and if you have spin, like you said, it's opposite the overlay momentum, then you can get even less thing compared to the non-spinning case. And you know, this is just some back of the envelope estimate of the luminosity of this kilonova effect that you get from this ejected material. So you know, this will sort of this velocity and amount of injected material will be reflected in the luminosity of this potential kilonova. And here is the gravitational wave from those same cases. So you can see here that basically for the lower spin cases, those are merging on this close encounter. So you get this merger ring down signal here. And then for some of the higher spin cases, sort of the, you know, effective innermost stable orbit for the system is moved out some, moved in some. And so those undergo another, go back out on a short elliptic orbit and then merge in these cases. And then this teal curve is the one we just saw the video of where even on the first encounter, it's, you know, very strongly tightly disrupted. So you get a very wimpy our merger signal. So now I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about simulations of binary neutron star mergers. In these cases, you know, we also expect to see an effect on the, you know, amount of ejecta and so on. But we also have additional effects because you know, when these two neutron stars merge, they'll form a hypermassive neutron star in a lot of the cases. And you can expect this extra angular momentum or deficit of angular momentum if it's in the opposite direction of the spin is in the opposite direction as the orbital angular momentum to either, you know, help or hurt the formation of a hypermassive neutron star. So I'll show some examples that illustrate that. And then also talk some about how the spin can affect the post-merger dynamics of this hypermassive neutron star, in particular this one-arm instability. So here's a little illustration. So on these two simulations are exactly the same, except in this case, on the left-hand side, we have two non-spinning stars. And on the right-hand case, we have two stars. They both have periods of 2.7 milliseconds. So in the non-spinning case, these two stars merge and you immediately collapse to a black hole. And then in this case, you actually get a hypermassive neutron star. And at least for the length of the simulation, which is longer than 20 milliseconds, this thing doesn't collapse at all, so it's pretty long lived.
Is it very spherical? How this neutron star, how does it look?
Yeah, so at these spins, it's not that sloshed.
I see. The other thing is, if one spin, I guess one spin is pointing in the opposite direction, this won't happen, right? Won't this happen?
Yeah, so if they're opposite, then you sort of the total additional angular momentum there shouldn't be any total initial angular momentum, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, so in fact, in those cases, it also collapses to a black hole. Yeah, and then more generically, you'd expect sort of some misaligned spin, and there'd be some component aligned with the orbital angular momentum and some.
So what are the critical parameters? Do you have any vision of when the crossover would happen? What are the values of the spin or the mass of the
particle? Yeah, so in the next slide, I'm going to sort of argue that the thermal effects are not that important here. But basically, it's the amount of total angular momentum. And so basically, if it's sort of around 0.8 in units of m squared, then those cases immediately collapse the black hole. And then the other cases, they don't.
So as far as the setup goes, the one on the right, these are 2 millisecond pulsars. Is that expected? I would have imagined that typical evolutionary paths will give you one sort of Hertz period, 1 second period object, and maybe a millisecond object, because the millisecond pulsars are all recycled.
Yes, but I mean, I think if you're imagining one of these dynamical capture scenarios, then they're because they sort of evolve independently, you don't expect any sort of correlation between the spins or their directions or anything like that. But I think that's not true if you consider these primordial binaries where they sort of form neutron stars in bound systems.
So the 0.2 was picked because A2's 0.2 was picked.
So that's sort of as I argued before, that's sort of the looking at the statistics in the collaborative cluster, it's like 12% or order of half life spins greater than that. But also just for this particular case to illustrate. So in the next slide I can show you where the cases with different spins. So this is sort of to convince you that it's mainly angular momentum that's affecting whether or not, like, immediately upon collapse or upon merger, these stars collapse or not. So here I'm showing you the total amount of thermal energy normalized by the internal energy for these different binary neutron star mergers as a function of time where the merger occurs here. And then these are for different spins. So you can see that basically for the first three cases, those all immediately collapsed to black holes, and that's why they're cut off here. And then for the higher spin cases, those produced hypermassive neutron stars that didn't collapse during the times we could simulate them. So the threshold is basically somewhere in between 0.1 and 0.2. And this is just to convince you that sort of in both cases, the amount of thermal energy is comparable at the time of collapse. But then sort of later, for the cases that don't collapse, then through all these oscillations and so on, you do get a lot of heating. So then sort of after this time, you do have a significant amount of thermal energy, which you might also need to cool in order for these things to finally collapse.
By thermal energy, do you just mean kinetic energy inside the neutron star, or do you mean something else?
Yeah, so like energy produced by shock heating. So you have like a cold equation of state, and then shock heating will produce some extra specific energy. So this is.
What kind of equation of state are you using?
This is like a piecewise polytrope.
And is this statement that angular momentum is all that matters? One star that wasn't spinning one with a 0.4, that would be qualitatively similar to the A.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's an experiment you've done?
Yes.
It meets the 8.2 halfway.
Yeah, right. I mean, you have two aligned, but it's totally angular momentum.
How bright is the second case is going to be? Because there's like a lot of material and the Neil simulations seem to be ejected as a neutrons, but the you know, beta decay, there are electrons, the magnetic field, so there will be a large flux in of visible gammas. I mean, do you see this or that's what it's kind of like?
Yes, I mean, like, I think these are definitely good candidates for generators of short gamma ray bursts and so on.
Yeah. So there's, as you said, a threshold between 0.1 and 0.2. Do you know what that is? Like, numerically, if you have that been?
No, I haven't tried to like narrow down, sort of tune on that for this particular case.
And do we know any way of theoretically estimating or computing? Estimating is what economists do, computing one of those.
I mean, from the other cases, you can sort of roughly disconnect it to the total amount of angular momentum. But
what I mean is it numerical experimentation that's going to tell us what that number is, or is there some other way of knowing it without doing it that way?
Yeah, I mean, I think at this that level of differentiation, you just need to do the simulation.
It has to be done by a simulation. It can't be done.
Right. I mean, certainly you can estimate it, but I mean.
Because it's an R naught here, which is the equation of state.
Right.
You're after a question.
Well, given the equation of state, right? I mean.
So then it becomes an academic question, not a.
Well,
let's look at nature question.
Yeah, I guess it is part of nature.
No,
still, I mean, there's clearly a threshold. I mean, I'm curious to know what it is and what it depends on. So.
Yeah, but this is a transformation. Yeah, the impact parameter. So now you can change it. It got an even impact parameter. You can change the impact parameter, and then you're going to have a different.
Oh, of course, that'll depend on that too. That's true.
Is this though not maybe a little bit easier than that? I mean, you have three reservoirs of angular momentum. Have the orbit, and then you have two stars. Now, the orbit angular momentum, I imagine most of it doesn't matter because it's being efficiently radiated away. And the two stars angular momentum is a way to carry this angular momentum into the final object. And then you just ask, what angular momentum do you need to support your supermassive neutron star, right?
That's what we were saying. To ballpark estimate you can get, but the details are important because, and depending on how much speed you have, the star will be more or less quiet.
But those details will all change as soon as you have the magnetic fields.
Sure,
I mean,
but
even
if you turn off the magnetic field,
even break the star.
The amount of differential rotation will be very important in helping you prevent or not a quick collapse of that. And then the thermal pressure, so all those things.
Yeah.
So ballpark one can get, the details are.
So basically the answer is it's going to depend on a lot of different variables that.
Yes.
Will, okay.
Yeah, so this is just the amount of unbound material bend into the velocity bends by their asymptotic velocity.
Sorry, I'm a bit about this, but it's kind of spin down, right? It cannot just be, any neutron star has some magnetic field that's going to spin down. It cannot be spinning at this large speed for a long time.
Right? Are you talking about the hypermassive neutron star before it emerges? Yeah, so I mean, definitely it's losing angular momentum. Well, in these simulations, because there's no magnetic fields, it's losing it to gravitational waves. And then you might also expect some magnetic field effects.
So eventually then it's going to collapse. So
that's why you use hypermassive instead of just massive. The total mass is above the maximum mass that this equation of state could support if the neutron star were cold and not differentially rotating. So you need to potentially get rid of one or both of those things. And so you can just sort of ballpark estimate, maybe like optimistically, how long it'll take for the star just to lose all its angular momentum to gravitational waves, just looking at the rate it's doing that at the end of the simulation. And that sort of gives you a number on the order of seconds. And then that's sort of also the time scale you'd expect these stars to start cooling by neutrinos or something like that. And then again, you also have to worry about magnetic fields and what they'll do in those time scales.
You're saying milliseconds?
Yeah, so most of these are 20 something milliseconds.
It's an order of magnitude longer than the other one, right? Remember, you gotta get to 2 seconds for a short camera somehow.
Yeah.
So this is another couple of steps like this.
Yeah, so this is just, again, the amount of unbound material for those different cases. And not surprisingly, you can see that, you know, for the cases that immediately collapse to black holes, you get very little material. And then for the cases that don't, you get more unbound material. And especially with these higher spins, you can get the sort of higher velocity tail.
So that's the amount of unbound material is on the vertical, and V yeah. infinity is how much velocity it has way up here.
Exactly. And so here's another case with the larger impact parameter. So the non-spinning case here is the black one. And you can see, not only for larger spin magnitudes, you get an enhancement, but also for these cases where one of the spins is anti-aligned with the orbital angular momentum, you also tend to get this high velocity tail, which is not entirely clear exactly how that's happening, but you do have this basically component to the spin that's canceling out the orbital angular momentum. And some of that seems to allow it to escape with higher velocity.
So Lewis machines all have a differential rotation, right?
Yeah, yeah. When generically when the stars merge, they'll produce a hypermassive neutron star that's
so
differentially rotating.
You expect a magnetic rotation on the stability to develop?
Yes.
And what's the time scale for that? Is that going to be, I think that's going to be shorter than a second, because that's
the
rotation. 100
milliseconds.
Yeah, so
100
milliseconds? So that 100
milliseconds. Yeah, I think it'll definitely start increasing, like even shorter time scales than that. And then, yeah, so then you definitely would sort of worry about effects from that and potentially having magnetic braking or something like that, which would affect the differential rotation. But I'm not including any of that here.
I'm a bit surprised this 100 milliseconds sounds a little bit too long, but that's you've seen well,
it. Well, TL grows and they need to play an effect.
Okay, so at 100 milliseconds, it does play an effect.
Okay,
I see.
Yeah, and here's just the example of a case where the stars don't sort of generically, you don't expect the stars to merge on their first close encounter. They'll undergo a number of these elliptic orbits, each time losing angular momentum and orbital energy until they finally merge. In this case, you can see these close encounters sort of generically excite these large F-mode oscillations in the star. And then eventually they merge. Yeah, so the sort of generic gravitational wave signal from these is you get a burst of gravitational waves each time you have a close encounter, and they'll be spaced by some longer period of time, and then eventually get this merger signal. So I want to talk a bit in detail about what happens to this hypermassive neutron star after it forms. In particular, this one-arm instability. So first of all, just some background. This one-arm instability, it's like an M equals one azimuth mode, was first discovered in Newtonian simulations of differentially rotating stars by Cincella et al. In 2001. And so basically this instability is not completely well understood, but there's been some work to try to understand its main features. In particular, there's this work by Saggio et al. And Watts et al. That connected the onset of this instability to developing a toroidal density configuration. So basically, the center of the star is not the maximum density. And then basically this instability can sit in by taking this point at the middle and displacing it from the center of mass. And so sort of show you some illustrations of that. This one-arm instability was also seen to develop in the neutron star cores in simulations of core collapse, and this work by Christian Out et al. And there's also some later work by Sajo and Yoshida in 2006 that connected the onset of this instability to having a co-rotation radius. That is, if you look at the rotation profile of the star at some radius, the frequency of rotation is equal to the frequency of this this mode. And when that happens, then the instability can undergo resonance and grow. So sort of the interesting thing is that this is not previously reported to be seen in hypermassive neutron stars that you got as a result of binary neutron star mergers until this work that I'm talking about. There were some potential hints, like in this work by Bernuzzi et al, where they did see the appearance of an N equals one mode, which in that paper they explained it as being due to mode coupling. But I think it's definitely an open question about what range of parameter space this instability occurs in. So I'll mention a little more about that towards the end of the talk.
Okay, what does this mean, instability? I mean, your thing is kind of a stable, so.
It's an instability in the sense that you can start with basically a very tiny M equals one mode, and then it'll grow to dominate. So.
If you show that last movie, you see it very clearly, actually.
Yeah, so, I'll show you a zoom in. So this is actually, this is a case where both the stars actually have not that big spins corresponding to 21 milliseconds. This is like a zoom in right as they're about to merge. So you can see when they merge, you get these sort of vortices at the interface between the two stars. And they sort of spiral in. And you get this under density at the middle of the star. And then as it rotates, it becomes displaced from the center, and you get this sort of wobbling pattern.
Okay, so it doesn't grow, I guess it's saturated.
Yeah,
I guess it's non-linear, it's saturated.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, but so, I mean, for this case, basically the two stars have equal spin, so they have this pi symmetry except for some like tiny noise. And so it basically grows from a very tiny N equals one node to dominating the star.
So that noise gets it.
Yeah, because of this instability. So I can show you, hopefully. So this is just that same case, but in addition to the density on the left, I'm also showing you the vorticity on the right. So you can see when they merge, you get these vortices at the interface, and some of them spiral outwards and get stretched away, but some go to the center. And that's, corresponds to this under density at the middle. And then eventually it spirals out from the center and is displaced, and then you get this wobbling density pattern. And so basically, as long as you run the simulation, it seems to maintain this amplitude. So to illustrate a little better, yes. to illustrate a little better, how this one-arm instability got its name, I can also show you the phase of this M equals one mode. So this is if you do decomposition of the density into different azimuthal modes and just look at the phase of the M equals one mode. And this is a similar case with twice the spin as the previous one. And so I'm just plotting in the equatorial plane, the the phase of that amplitude multiplied by its radius. So, you know, right now this is at merger and it's a big mess. But sort of, if you wait, you know, order 5 or 8 milliseconds, it starts to develop this coherent structure. Yeah, so it's basically just this C equals one is just take the density and then just with M equals one here, integrate it here. Is there? Yeah, so just this C1 is just a function of your like cylindrical radius and the Z coordinate. And you just get by taking the density and integrating over the azimuthal component. And so basically the phase of this corresponds to where the overdensity is and where the underdensity is. And so I'm just taking this and multiplying it by the cylindrical radius. Yeah, so this this basically shows the one arm structure. We have this you know, coherent structure that looks to be almost rigidly rotating, and then it has this tail that goes in behind it, and it's, you know, going around about 1.7 kilohertz. Yeah, so. So here again, I'm showing you these different instead of the phase, I'm showing you the amplitude of these different azimuthal modes. So the M equals 1, 2, 3, and 4. So you can see initially, so this is the case where actually one of the stars has a slightly larger spin than the other one. So you start off with the small M equals 1 node, but it's, you know, definitely dominated by the M equals 2 mode because you have two stars merging. But sort of on order of 10 millisecond timescales, the M equals 1 mode is growing and then saturating at this amplitude, and it sort of persists at this amplitude, and the other modes are going down. So I have to apologize for the colors here, they don't quite correspond, but this is the gravitational waves from the same case. The 2-2 mode, which is in red, corresponds to the red one here. That's the quadruple mode. And then the black curve here is the L equals 2, M equals 1 component of the gravitational wave signal. And you can see that as here, it sort of grows by several orders of magnitude and then saturates at this level. You know, the frequencies here match here. And so basically the M equals 1 mode is about at 1.7 kilohertz, and then the M equals 2 mode is at twice that frequency, and the M equals 3 is 3 times, and so on. You know, as you expect if you had some structure that was sort of rigidly rotating. And here's another case where you have a smaller impact parameter, but larger spins. And you can sort of see that it has qualitatively similar behavior. It takes longer for sort of the M equals 2 mode to die down and the M equals 1 mode to dominate. You know, here it's order 20 milliseconds, but eventually it does.
But if this is not rigid, you do have differential
rotation.
Yeah. But it's misleading.
Yeah. So I mean, I can there's actually the like rotation profile for some of these cases. So there's like part of it where it's like this, the arm part of it that is sort of flat, almost like a constant rotation speed, and then the core is rotating much faster, and then the bottom part is a bit lower. Yeah, so you can also sort of ask, you know, how detectable these gravitational wave signals might be. Here's several different cases with different spins, including the non-spinning case, all with the same impact parameter. And you can see they all give sort of similar curves. You get this peak at about 1.7 kilohertz. Corresponding to the m equals 1 mode, and then you get one at twice the frequency corresponding to the quadrupole mode, and then so on for the 3 and the 4. You can see that the fact that the m equals 1 mode is lower in amplitude is almost made up for by the fact that if you look at, you know, one of these ground-based gravitational wave detectors, they are more sensitive at these lower frequencies. Of course, you know, for most of these plots for looking at the gravitational wave signals from the hypermassive neutron star, it's kind of depressing. This is at 10 megaparsecs. The thing to note is this is just for 15 milliseconds of integration time. And basically at the end of the simulation, you know, as you saw in the previous plot, the amplitude seems to be remaining constant. So it's not unexpected that these signals would last for much longer times than we can simulate them. Though, you know, you do start to worry about, you know, things that are not taken into account, like magnetic fields and whether or not there could be magnetic breaking of the differential rotation or so on. But just taking sort of naive estimate, like I mentioned before, for, you know, the total amount of angular momentum and how fast it's radiating away, that gives you time scales in an order of seconds.
So along those lines, so Luis had said 100 milliseconds before the magnetic field become dynamically important. Is that a lot of interesting things are happening in these vortices that you're at the interface and then the long-lived vortice that lives at the end, and you have this much higher rotation rate at the center. Is it 100 milliseconds uniform? Is that when it starts to matter there? Or can it matter in those regions much earlier?
Yeah.
So it is in those regions where you actually, initially you think these are realistic, whatever magnetic fields, these are tend to be 11 Gauss. So their role in the energy of the system is nothing. It's 10, 12 orders of magnitude below the binding energy of the system. So you need to grow into sufficient volume. And so then this is where this 100 millisecond time scale comes from. But no one has actually simulated this for that long with the resolution required to actually capture those very fine features correctly.
But you can do a very simple thing: ask how many rotations of the vortex.
Sure. And this vortex has to be fine.
And so that's the E fold.
This vortex has to be fine.
Okay. Is there any chance of compressing fields in the vortices?
Compressing?
I mean, will ambient fields get compressed as
yes.
the vortices form? Will that change historically?
It could, but again, you need to grow it to 10 to the, you need to go to at least 10 to 16 Gauss before you can actually begin to get pieces of this star that will be boring and things like that.
Yeah, but I think, yeah, there definitely, that is something you need to investigate, because it's definitely not conceivable that it is going to go to that 10 to 16 Gauss through MRI or so on, sort of definitely. Definitely on these timescales. Yeah, so as I showed, it seems like those spin can sort of help sort of help see this instability. And in those cases with spin, you sort of see the one arm mode dominate faster. It doesn't seem to be essential. And in particular, I showed you that non-spinning case where you also saw the one arm instability. At least for the simulations we've done, it seems like we see the m equals one mode dominate after some time for the cases where the sort of total angular momentum is in the range of 0.9 to 1 in units of n squared. And so that's also sort of the regime that's relevant for quasi-circular mergers. So I think, you know, one interesting question is whether or not this will occur in at least some part of the parameter space for quasi-circular mergers, and you know, basically why people haven't seen it before.
Does the fluid rotate with the pattern, or is it just, does it go through the pattern? Like when you think of like a spiral bottom, it starts actually go through the stuff, so it's just a wave that goes through. So it wasn't clear for me here that when you say there's this arm that's rotating, is it just the fluid that's rotating with the arm, it's just going, fluid it just goes into the arm and then comes out the arm. Does that make sense?
I mean, the fluid is definitely rotating, and like, you know, if you take a look at this rotating.
Yeah, but it's the same angular frequency as the arm.
Yeah, so this right here is the angular frequency of the mode. And you can see sort of in this regime. Exactly. Yeah.
So it's not a wave that's going through the fluid, it's just the fluid itself that's rotating there. It's a concentration that's working this on.
Yeah, so you know, definitely a lot of, there's still some open questions here. You know, one is how this depends on the equation of state. That's one thing I'm looking into now. Another is you know, how this depends on orbital parameters, and in particular, you know, whether or not it also will occur for at least some equations of state or so on for quasi-circular. So that's work that started collaboration with Antonio Socaris, who has a code for constructing quasi-circular initial data with spinning neutron stars. So that's one thing we're looking into. And then another open question, you know, as I mentioned before, is, you know, what is the effect of magnetic fields on these hypermassive neutron stars, and will the magnetic braking, you know, affect this differential rotation or not? Yeah. So concludes my talk. So just in summary, you know, I want to say that, first of all, I demonstrated how spin can have important effects on black hole neutron star and binary neutron star mergers, in particular affecting the amount of ejected material, which might power some transient. Another interesting thing was this one-arm instability that we showed that can occur in hypermassive neutron stars that you get from binary neutron star mergers, and has a very strong effect on the dynamics of the resulting hypermassive neutron star. And this is reflected in the gravitational wave signal from these events. And, you know, for future work, want to address whether or not this occurs in quasi-circular mergers as well. Thank you.
Was the expected frequency of, say, neutron star merger inside the Milky Way? Is it often? I mean, how often?
Inside the Milky Way, it's very low.
Yeah, but is it like 1 per 1,000 years?
I think it's much
less.
But the expectancy farther away, right?
Yes.
10 megaparsec.
Or, I mean, advanced
value,
you
should
see for a few.
Very naively, if 10 minus 3 of mass of the solar masses is injected, right, you could still see it in optical or something, you know, in gammas far away.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, then if you see Chogham reversed, one option is these systems are these. well, binary, non-binary, compact binary star being source of short memory bursts, does that seem to, from cosmologic perspective.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
the IOS is not less than that. So the IOS we see in these systems to 500 megaparsecs, 600 megaparsecs at the moment, binary black hole to a gigaparsec, and short memory bursts being seen to questions.
Yeah, and I think the kind of thing is, I don't think we've seen a short gamma ray burst that's in the advanced LIGO volume. Yeah.
But is it 500 megaparsecs the distance? I thought that sounds too big.
So for black hole neutron stars, you get to up to 600 megaparsecs. For black hole neutron stars, to about 300 megaparsecs.
Yeah. Are you saying there is a short gamma ray burst? It's
closer
than. So
that
is at 0.1, there isn't less than.
The funny thing is that when people talk about rates, if you assume the short memory bursts are produced by the systems, then you can estimate based on oscillations how many you would expect in LIGO and C, and you get about 30 and the kind of what they call realistic rates from population synthesis would indicate about 40, which is very convenient. But it's a win we say, unfortunately, they come. It has not been the short memory burst seen to 400 megaparsecs. So
is that a beaming effect, really, or?
No, so when they get this estimate, they correct for all that.
But
yeah, this is not beam, not beam, but then the optical signal is beam. So that's, so you don't expect to see
so,
all that.
You're right, so you could, that
could be consistent with
right,
that.
Right.
Well, what is the smallest redshift for known
there's a top by Edo Berger.
I thought they were like 0.1. 0.1 would be 400, 500
megaparsecs. It's 300.
Yeah, yeah,
so
I think it's 0.3. But, I mean, I know it's a his paper last year. We can check.
I mean, maybe there's a difference between saying there hasn't been one inside advanced LIGO volume during the.
It has to be one observed. Yeah, that's Edo. Edo, yeah, remember, it's so.
And the spectral features of this short gamma ray was consistent with neutron star burden?
Well,
the
story is building up more and more in that direction. So, one, they identify where they come from. Typically, they come from non star forming regions. So it's more older populations, which is more consistent with the binary than it is with the magnetar. That's one. Second, they have seen, okay, there's only one report, maybe two, this kilonova associated to it. This kilonova is easily explained, or you can accommodate it comfortably well within the compact binary merger, and you cannot in the magnetar. Okay, so the evidence is building up towards binaries as opposed to magnetar. So the magnetar is not completely out of the picture because in this merger that this hypermassive neutron star, as you increase the magnetic field to this 10 to 16 Gauss, you actually produce a magnetar through the merger of lots. So then that picture comes back, but as a product, a byproduct of the merger. Any other questions?
I found one that has a 0.22.
0.225.
Yeah,
that's 0.225.
That's
0.3.
That's 200. Well, that's
a shorter.
0.1 is 3. So it's
closer, yeah. No, yes, 0.1 is 300. So, yes, you're right.
So
0.2 is too far. It's far, you're right. But you said 0.3, so this is closer than 3.
No, it's closer. 0.225 is closer to 0.3 than 0.1.
Okay.
Okay, let's take a minute.